and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for September 24th, 2010. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, measuring relativity with optical clocks, whether to move plants and animals threatened by climate change, and the impasse over federal funding for stem cell research in the United States. All this and more, plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about how self-love contributes to real-world success from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Albert Einstein's theories of relativity predict that if you are close to a massive object, like the Earth, then time goes a little slower than it does if you are far away from the massive object. Time dilates as well when you are moving compared to sitting still, with time going a little slower for the moving person than for the stationary one. Experiments with very accurate clocks high above the Earth, as well as at high speeds, have shown this time dilation does occur. But now, in a paper in this week's Science, Chengwen Chao and colleagues have measured time dilating for objects traveling no faster than a child running and at distances from the Earth less than the distance between your head and your belly, assuming you are standing up, that is. The measurements all come from having a better, more accurate clock. The research suggests applications in geophysics, hydrology, and other ways of measuring the Earth, and the clocks may help in the future with better global positioning services and improving the internet. I spoke with Chao from his office at the U.S. National Institute of Standards and Technology in Boulder, Colorado.
So we just have one clock in oscillatory motion, and it's like the speed of you sitting on a swing, slowly swinging, and we can just look at the clock and see that when you are swinging, your time passes more slowly compared to the one that's sitting and not moving. And the other interesting experiment we did was just by getting one of the clock a bit higher, just a bit more than a foot higher, we can see that it's ticking a bit faster. So these are all described by the relativity theories by Albert Einstein. So the time dilation caused by clock moving is described in special relativity. And the effect of height is actually from the gravitational potential difference, as described by the general theory of relativity.
What is it about these optical clocks that allows for such precise measurements?
So there are several advantages using these optical clocks. First is the ticking rate is at optical frequencies. So we can divide time into finer and finer units, and then we can more precisely measure time. And the other advantage of these clocks is that they are based on single atom. So we refer our time or frequency to a stable transition in the atom. In our case, it's a single aluminum ion held stationary in space. And because we are referencing our frequency to a single particle, it's like a single point in space, we can control the condition of that single point in space really well. So we can zero out the magnetic field, we can zero out the electric field fluctuations just at that single point. And then we can control the motion of the aluminum, single aluminum ion really well. So these are all effects that would lead to variation in the frequency the clock produces. So if we can reduce the variation in all these factors, we can have a really precise frequency, a really accurate clock. That's the advantage of the clock we have.
And compared to previously reported optical clocks, how much of an improvement are these two clocks that you and your team used in your experiments?
Well, so we are pretty much working on single ion optical clocks, so I won't talk about the improvement over our own clocks. But just compared to other optical clocks, there are optical clocks based on a group of neutral atoms. Those are not charged, so they are just neutral atoms. So the record now is still like 10 times less accurate than the clocks we have. So they are still a factor of 10 lag behind, but they are quickly catching up.
In the time dilation experiment, you and your team reported that you could measure this time dilation due to the velocity of only a few meters per second. You said oscillatory motion, like swinging in a swing.
Yeah.
Did you just simply move the clock back and forth?
Okay. We didn't move the whole clock apparatus, but we moved the ion. We reference the frequency to the ion. So if the ion is moving, the time it's keeping is actually changing. So we simply just get the single ion into oscillatory motion, and we try to see what the frequency is going to produce. So that's how we set the clock into motion in the time dilation measurement.
And you move the ion with some electric field?
That's right. So the ion is driven by an oscillatory electric field. It's oscillating at radio frequency, about 60 megahertz.
And this is something that's stable and not going to introduce any error into measuring these ions?
Yeah, so we have a way to measure the motion. It's going to modulate something. It's going to cause a measurable effect that we can measure independently. So we know the ion is just in oscillatory motion, and we know how fast it was going. And then we separately measured the frequency of the clock and compare it to the clock with an ion at rest. So we separately assess the state of motion.
The applied electric field being one that's stable enough and precise enough.
Yeah, they just cause motion. So they are pretty stable to just cause the effect we want them to cause. So oscillating electric field does cause frequency shift, but it's at this time, it's still negligible. It's still like less than, well, should I say 10 to the minus 20? So it's still small enough. We don't have to worry about it now. But as the accuracy of the clocks improves, say if we get another tenfold improvement in accuracy, we would have to start worrying about the effect of oscillating electric field. But at this point in the current paper, we don't have to worry about that oscillating electric field.
Okay. How did you and your team measure the gravitational potential? Was this just having the clocks at different heights?
Yeah.
That's it?
Yeah. Well, the gravitational potential is, well, if you're at the same height, most likely you are at the same gravitational potential. We know our clocks, although they are in different labs, the gravity field should be pretty uniform for these two clocks. So we just use the height difference to derive the difference in the gravitational potential. In the measurement, what we did was we simply just lift up the whole apparatus for one of the clocks. We just use a hydraulic jack to raise it up by 33 centimeters. And then the two clocks, just by comparing their frequencies, we see the tiny shift due to this height change. So that's how we measure gravitational potential difference with these two accurate clocks.
Now, as I understand it, these two clocks are tethered together by a special 75-meter cable. Mm-hmm. Before you can construct a network of these clocks to be useful in precise measurements of the whole Earth or a continent or a larger area, do you need just longer cables or something else?
Even if we have a network of fibers for like 100 or 1,000 kilometers, it's not enough for connecting clocks because we don't want any external effects such as the fluctuations in the fiber length or temperature or any acoustic noise that would come into the optical frequencies we send across the fiber. So this is another requirement for our technique to be really useful for large-scale survey of the Earth's gravitational potential. We need a really stable link, and it's currently under active investigation how we can transmit stable optical frequency signal through a network of optical fiber that's of continental size. So that's one requirement we would need to accomplish for our technique to be expanded over the size of a globe.
Qingwen Chao, thank you very much.
No problem.
Qingwen Chao, the U.S. National Institute of Standards and Technology, is lead author of a paper on observing time dilation using optical clocks.
Climate change is forcing dramatic changes to species habitats. So as the planet warms, habitats are changing, and this is compounded by habitat fragmentation caused by human activity.
Science's Richard Stone reports in this week's issue on the debate among conservationists and ecologists over whether to move plants and animals threatened by climate change.
So you have species that are having to adapt to various kinds of pressures, both the pressure of human activity and the pressure of global warming. This is particularly evident, for example, in mountain terrains, where as temperatures rise, species that are adapted to a particular climate regime are forced higher and higher up a mountain until basically at some point they will run out of space, they will run out of habitat. The question is, what should be done? Should scientists try to help species migrate? This concept is called assisted colonization.
What, if any, consensus is there about moving species threatened by climate change, this assisted colonization?
There are a few points of consensus. One point is that any assisted colonization effort must proceed with great caution. Both advocates and critics of the idea cite the fact that there's very little data out there to say whether moving particular species is going to be benign to the recipient ecosystem or set off some kind of ecological chain reaction which causes great damage to the new ecosystem. So there's one point, there's a lack of data, and there's a second point, the need to proceed with caution. And there are lots of cautionary tales out there of species translocations that have gone wrong.
Tell me about one.
Well, one famous example is the cane toad. It was introduced in Australia in the 1930s. It was brought from Hawaii, and the idea was that the cane toad would consume beetles that were ravaging sugar cane crops. As it turned out, the toad had little effect on the cane beetles, and the toad spread widely and became a pest in its own right. It makes a toxin that has been blamed for declines in predators poisoned by the toxin. And this is just one of many ecological train wrecks where you have an apparently benign and well-meaning introduction that turns into a real disaster.
And why assisted colonization, this moving species about, instead of breeding threatened species in captivity, say?
That's a very critical debate, and some of the critics of assisted colonization have argued that the technique may divert precious resources away from habitat restoration, conservation, or even captive breeding, other approaches to saving species. So there's a lot of concern that the scientific case for assisted colonization has not been made yet. Now, the backers of assisted colonization say that there are, in fact, good reasons to be very cautious about this, that it may be not appropriate for the vast majority of species. And you have to look at it case by case and say, for example, will captive breeding give the species a better chance at adapting and surviving in a changing world, or will assisted colonization prove to be a much more likely successful approach?
So what are the criteria? How are scientists choosing which species to move to different locations?
So far, there's been a lot of debate about what the criteria should be. And there was a policy forum in Science a couple of years ago that tried to frame the debate to lay out a risk assessment paradigm for deciding when to attempt assisted colonization. And this group argued that to be a colonization candidate, a species must be at high risk of decline or extinction because of climate change. It would have to be feasible to move and establish the species elsewhere. And the benefits of relocation would have to outweigh the biological and socioeconomic costs. And that last point in particular is the one that's extremely contentious because it's just so hard to actually judge what the potential costs are.
Are there any examples where assisted colonization has gone well?
it's been carried out with very few species. It's really a relatively new concept to try to move species in response to climate change, which is what people are talking about now. There's lots of introductions that were made for other reasons where, you know, you attempt to introduce a species into a new ecosystem, for example, to get rid of a pest. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But particularly in response to climate change, there have been perhaps two noteworthy cases. One case is an experiment done about 10 years ago in England, where researchers moved populations of two species of butterflies from their then present habitat to a habitat to the north, which was likely to be a suitable habitat as temperatures rose. So they've been monitoring the populations, and the researchers say that the species appear to be behaving quite naturally. The other example is a bit more controversial. It's a citizens group, the Toria Guardians, who have been sending seeds of the Toria pine to people in locations far outside the recent habitat of this pine tree. And the reason they do this is because the pine tree has been decimated. There's very few remaining in the wild. And the citizens group has tried to save the species in what they call assisted migration. And some researchers say that there's a moral justification for doing this, that the Toria Guardians have a right to try to fix a problem that they don't see anyone else dealing with. But then there are other researchers who are quite nervous about the fact that basically any group could move any species they want to, and that the consequences could be quite bad if the scientific case hasn't been very carefully assessed.
Rich, you're in China. How are scientists there viewing assisted colonization?
Scientists here are, like their colleagues abroad, they are grappling with the issue about whether it is a good approach. And one example that I write about in this article is orchids. The Guangxi province in southwestern China is one of nine orchid hotspots in the world. And here, there are particular species of orchids that are threatened down to the last couple hundred orchids of that species. And what do you do? Do you try to protect the orchids, taking the usual approach, which is preserving the habitat, trying to breed the orchids? Or do you try to be more assertive and actually picking up the orchids and moving them to a new suitable habitat? It's something which scientists here are trying to assess now.
The fact that scientists are doing this, moving species threatened by climate change, what, if any, effect is that having on potential policy changes, reducing our effect on climate change?
I don't think it's having an impact yet. I think a lot of the debate about assisted colonization right now is still theoretical. There are very few instances where scientists have attempted to translocate species because of climate change. But it's clear, it's evident here in China, climate change is nudging temperatures higher. It's disrupting rainfall patterns. It's reducing the frequency of foggy days. So this is affecting a broad range of species. And the debate about whether to do something about this, to actually lend a hand to embattled species, pick them up and move them, I think that debate is just going to continue to grow. It's very hard to judge whether it's going to have an impact on policy, the need to address the root cause of climate change, and that's, of course, increased greenhouse gas emissions.
Rich Stone, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Rob. It was a pleasure.
Science's Rich Stone reports in this week's issue on the debate among conservationists and ecologists over whether to move plants and animals threatened by climate change. Also in this week's Science, restoring populations of panthers. 20 years ago, only around 25 panthers lived in the state of Florida, inbred and unhealthy, which led researchers at the time to predict that the panther population would very likely be extinct by now. 15 years ago, however, conservation managers imported 8 panthers from the state of Texas. Now, in a paper in this week's Science, Warren Johnson and colleagues report that this restoration experiment has led to a 3-fold increase in the panther population, improved fitness, and a decline in inbreeding. But there are still many challenges ahead for this panther population, including continued habitat loss. Read the paper, Genetic Restoration of the Florida Panther, and a Related Perspective, in this week's Science. Last week, the United States Congress held a hearing on federal funding for human embryonic stem cell research. Funding for such research was temporarily suspended after a judge's ruling in August that the National Institutes of Health's use of federal funds for human embryonic stem cell research violated the Dickey Wicker Amendment. This amendment, added annually to a funding bill, prohibits government funding of research that destroys human embryos. Senator Roger Wicker, co-author of the amendment, spoke at the hearing.
In my opinion, the body of scientific evidence developed since 1995 has served only to strengthen the argument in favor of Dickey Wicker. But the basic premise for the provision has not changed. It is this. Number one, the destruction of or cloning of human embryos for research purposes raises profound moral and ethical challenges. Number two, the federal government should not be involved in subsidizing this controversial life-altering research with taxpayer dollars. Number three, there are limited federal funds available for health-related research. Number four, if human embryonic research is to be done at all, it should be paid for with non-taxpayer funds.
The researchers who brought that suit that resulted in the judge's decision, James Shirley and Teresa Deicher, argued that allowing research on human embryonic stem cells made competition for funds harder and decreased their chances of securing federal funds for their research on adult stem cells. To Sean Morrison, a researcher who testified at the hearing, it's that competition for funds that makes science in the United States so good. Morrison directs the University of Michigan's Center for Stem Cell Biology.
American science is the envy of the world because it's a meritocracy in which there's fierce competition to fund the best ideas. If we accept the principle that those who are not judged to have the best ideas can obtain judicial relief that blocks funding of the best ideas to allow the lesser ideas to compete, this will erode the very heart of American competitiveness. We owe more to the patients suffering from incurable diseases. We owe it to them to support all forms of stem cell research so that no matter where the science leads and where the cures come from, we can follow the most promising avenues of discovery.
George Daly agrees. Daly is a stem cell researcher working at Children's Hospital in Boston and Harvard Medical School, who also testified at the hearing.
It's very curious. It's the only time I confront the argument that adult stem cells are superior and that embryonic stem cells should be replaced is at hearings like this. At scientific meetings, we discuss and debate adult and embryonic and induced pluripotent stem cells as all complementary aspects of cell and developmental biology. In my opinion, the arguments that adult stem cells obviate the need for embryonic stem cells are not scientifically driven. They are ideologically driven arguments to suppress ES cell research. And no matter how much progress is made with other forms of stem cells, ES cells will remain a vital research tool.
But the scientist at the hearing also responded to the ideological, ethical questions surrounding human embryonic stem cell research. Francis Collins, director of the National Institutes of Health, testified at the hearing, responding to a question why he, as a person of faith, is comfortable with this kind of research.
In terms of the consequences of in vitro fertilization efforts, benevolent as they are, giving couples a chance to have children who otherwise could not, one of those consequences is the existence of hundreds of thousands of frozen embryos and others that are being discarded potentially all the time. And then faced with the ethical choice in that situation, I have come to the conclusion as a person of faith that the alternative of discarding this embryo that's clearly not going to get used versus, for a small number of these, trying to turn them into a stem cell line that might ultimately teach us something about human development and medicine and ultimately help us come up with a treatment for Parkinson's disease or diabetes or spinal cord injury or some eye disease or liver disease. Which of those is the more ethical choice?
Next week, another court hearing is scheduled to determine whether federal funding should continue while the case is being litigated. The court is widely expected to make a decision quickly.
It seems likely that whichever side loses in the judicial proceedings, there may be an appeal.
David Moore is Senior Director for Government Relations at the Association of American Medical Colleges, a group that favors federal support of human embryonic stem cell research.
So there may be a series of resolutions here, a series of decision points that are made in the judicial process, but that may extend out over an extended period of time. I think the uncertainty with this situation is something that has a chilling effect on research, certainly for young people considering entering into this particular field of science, not knowing whether or not this research will be eligible for federal funding, and not knowing whether that question is going to be resolved judicially for a year or 18 months or 2 years, definitely has an impact. One of the reasons why we believe that Congress really does need to articulate what their intent was here, and should do that sooner rather than later, although I think the likelihood that Congress is going to be able to address this in the immediate short term is probably pretty small.
And given that Congress will soon be in recess, the various bills introduced earlier this year, or any other bills introduced to legislate solutions to this question of funding human embryonic stem cell research, likely won't be voted on until after the elections in November. You can follow Science's ongoing coverage of the stem cell injunction on Science's policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org. Finally today, Science's Kristen Minogue is sitting in for David Grimm with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about how self-love contributes to real-world success. How so?
Well, it turns out that if you have egomaniacs in your group, it can actually help you be more creative, even if egomaniacs aren't more creative themselves. So they looked at different pairs of students and told each pair to try and pitch a movie idea to their partner. And movie ideas were in general pretty bad ideas. The best one they said was of a mafia run by a woman. But it turned out that even if the narcissists pitched average or pretty bad ideas, they were also 50% more likely to convince their partner that it was a good idea.
So something about the communication of the idea by the narcissist versus the not narcissist.
Exactly. The idea is that narcissists are better at putting ideas on the table and making them sound good because they themselves perhaps believe they're good.
And how do you identify a narcissist from not a narcissist?
They used a 16-item questionnaire, which was called the Narcissistic Personality Inventory, to see who was the most egocentric of their group.
And there was some sort of cutoff to say, okay, you're a narcissist, you're not?
It was more like a scale, actually, Rob. They were looking at who was the most egocentric of these different students who they analyzed.
Beyond movie pitching, what implications does this have for real-world success?
I guess it shows fake it till you make it. Because even if your idea is terrible, if you believe that it's good, you can also convince someone else that it's good.
And is that how other researchers are seeing it, too, as advice for faking it till you make it?
Well, of course, there's a dark side to it as well, which means that an idea that actually does suck, that if you're a narcissist, someone could believe it's a good idea when it's actually not.
Okay. Well, thanks, Kristen. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, we have one about how to make aluminum as strong as steel.
And how do you go about doing that?
Well, I guess, first of all, the reason aluminum is so great is because it's so light. But it's also very fragile, as you can probably tell if you've ever tried to smash a can with your foot. It's very easy to do, or even with one hand. You can smash it. So trying to find a way to make it stronger, so perhaps it could be used for cars or in body armor for soldiers.
So how do you make this aluminum as strong as steel?
Well, the process they used is called high-pressure torsion, and what it entails is basically taking a very thin disc of this aluminum alloy and smashing it between two anvils at very, very high pressures and rotating one of them. And then you take it out, let it sit at room temperature for about a month, and when it's entirely finished, the atomic structure of the aluminum has been so rearranged that the aluminum is now 3 times stronger than it was before.
So it's not a function of making the aluminum more dense. It's actually something about the structure of the aluminum on an atomic scale.
Yes, it has more to do with the atomic structure than actually making the aluminum more dense or more packed. But they really aren't sure how exactly this atomic structure makes it stronger. They just observed that it does. For example, a square meter of this new aluminum alloy could hold the weight of an aircraft carrier.
Alloy. So what else is going into this alloy besides just aluminum?
Well, it also includes some amounts of zinc and magnesium.
Have scientists probed down to see what's happening on the atomic scale?
Yes, they did. And they used an atom probe tomography technique. And they discovered that it was a new arrangement of the atoms. It's called a hierarchical nanostructure, in which the aluminum atoms, the aluminum grains, were actually reduced. and you have zinc and magnesium atoms clustered together in variously sized groups, depending on whether they were located inside the aluminum grains or on the edges.
So even though researchers don't exactly know how it works, I imagine they're starting to think of these applications, like you mentioned, car or body armor, things like that. Are they going to be able to produce it in large enough quantities to make that actually viable?
Well, it's probably not ready for making the massive cars or aircraft carriers yet, but it could be used in smaller things for hospitals, for example, knee implants or hip implants.
An alternative to titanium, then?
Yes, it could be.
Okay. So last story, what's this last one about?
So our last story is about how the ice on Antarctica can actually tell us something about the universe.
How so?
Well, because it's kind of an inadvertent detector of cosmic rays. And cosmic rays are very, very small, very, very fast particles that come from outer space, anywhere beyond the Earth's atmosphere. And they can tell us about the sun's composition or as far away as the edge of our galaxy. But the really, really high-energy ones only come very rarely. And so we have to spread detectors across huge, huge swaths of land to actually try and pick them up.
So is the idea then to spread these across the Antarctic surface?
No, it wasn't actually. The discovery that the ice could be used to help with this was a complete accident. There was a different project using a hot air balloon to try and detect neutrinos. They're also really, really tiny particles that have no charge at all, and they're famous for interacting with nothing at all, also from outer space. But this project took this detector over the Arctic ice about 30 kilometers above it, and they picked up a signal, they analyzed it, and thought it was just one event initially. But about a year later, they looked at it more closely and realized that it was actually 16 separate events, and they weren't neutrinos, they were these cosmic rays instead.
So what was it about being above the ice that researchers think is helpful?
So the neutrinos they were trying to find in the first place would bounce off the ice and emit radio waves, which then their detector would pick up these radio waves and try and analyze them. It turns out the cosmic rays did something very, very similar to this. They would bounce off the ice and emit a signal that they could pick up, and then they could analyze that.
How did they determine that it was from these cosmic rays as opposed to something else that the detector might have picked up?
Well, to begin with, these 16 different events had come from the control data, not their signal data. And secondly, they tried to figure out if it was human activity, and it didn't correspond to any of their activities like using walkie-talkies. So they figured that it couldn't really be anything else besides cosmic rays.
And how are other researchers responding to this?
Well, they think that it's a very interesting finding, but they haven't really shown that this technique using the ice and a hot air balloon can really compete with the arrays on the ground that cover hundreds of square kilometers. They think it still has a long way to go. They think that it needs some more developing to prove itself. So the team has chosen to tweak the instrument so it can detect both neutrinos and cosmic rays. And the next flight is planned for 2013.
Okay. Kristen, thank you very much.
Thank you, Rob.
Science's Kristen Minogue sitting in for David Grimm with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news from our online daily news site, Science Now. Find these stories, along with many more, plus all the stories on the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
And that wraps up the September 24th, 2010 Science Magazine podcast. Thanks to Sophia Kai, Barbara Jasny, Aaron Heath, and Brad Weibel for their help with this week's show. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Tretterick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.